And I saw my dentist, too, another beauty. I said to him, Doc, look at my teeth. They're all getting yellow. He told me to wear a brown necktie.
To me, it's a little weird for a doctor to specialize in proctology, for that matter. I'm sure he has his reasons, but who makes that decision? Come out of medical school, here's the whole human body. Where do I want to hang? Okay, no, feet, nothing in the front. What do you got in the back? No, back of the head, no. Yeah. Now we're getting somewhere.
What's wrong with you?
It's either this show or indigestion. I hope it's indigestion.
Why?
It'll get better in a little while.
Now open your mouth and let's have a look at that brain.
We have an obesity epidemic in the USA. One out of every three Americans weighs as much as the other two, which to me...
What's up, Fletcher?
Your cholesterol!
Dr. Barry Dworkin is here taking health-related phone calls for the next hour, and every single phone line is available, folks. Right now, you'll have no trouble getting through at all. The wait won't be too long. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580, or 1-800-580-CFRA. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Carly Weeks writes in the Globe and Mail, there was breast versus bottle, then crib sleeping versus co-sleeping. Now the latest infant-rearing technique to stir controversy and confuse even the most confident baby Bjorn-clad parents is swaddling. Now, listen, swaddling was good enough for the Son of God. It should be good enough for everybody else. But the Globe and Mail continues. For the uninitiated, swaddling involves snugly wrapping infants in a blanket to restrict movement. It's been around for thousands of years, see Bible Jesus. But it has grown steadily in popularity even in the past decade. Swaddling babies, according to proponents of the technique, sleep longer, they fuss less, and they have a lower risk of SID, sudden infant death syndrome. As the practice gains a bigger following, however, questions about safety are prompting some hospitals to speak out against it, and are causing many converts to have second thoughts. Quote, real parents shouldn't be doing this, says Maureen Luther, pediatric physiotherapist, Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center in Toronto. Swaddling is not that beneficial. What do you think?
Well, as with any claim that is being made, you have to look at what evidence people have either for or against this particular practice. And when you look at the literature that's out there, there really isn't much on any of that. So you're really dealing with anecdote and quote-unquote expert opinion, which is actually the worst type of advice anybody can get. Expert opinion doesn't necessarily depend upon evidence, just somebody giving their opinion based on their experience in dealing with the population that's for which you're concerned. The swaddling issue, I think, is really, it's really something that I look at this and I go, do we have anything else that we want to talk about? Because for the most part, most of the parents, and again, we can only be anecdotal, Rob, so I can only deal with what I see in my practice.
Sure.
Because there's no other information out there.
Okay.
And so, yes, the babies are swaddled right after birth. You know, we do a delivery, you know, we're in the case room, delivery room, and the baby is swaddled. Well, frankly, the baby was swaddled for 9 months, so swaddling it for another few hours is unlikely to cause any harm to the baby. In fact, it may be very comfortable for it. It keeps it warm. It's not a matter of restricting movement, just keeps it warm. And what we also encourage at the same time is skin-to-skin contact with the mom after birth. So the baby really isn't swaddled. There's just a blanket over it, and it's essentially lying on the mom's breast or chest and being warmed that way. So really, I don't see what the issue is.
It is an issue. It's in the Globe and Mail, for crying out loud.
I don't see how this interferes with development. They're saying babies are restricted from moving.
Okay, let me continue here and get your reaction.
All right.
Few, if any, Canadian institutions endorse or recommend the practice in some of the country's largest maternity hospitals, including Mount Sinai and Sunnybrook, as well as agencies that oversee perinatal services in the province of British Columbia are moving away from swaddling healthy newborns. In most institutions, it is still recommended that premature babies or those exposed to drugs in utero be swaddled to provide comfort. Several studies Several studies have linked swaddling to a higher risk of respiratory infections and, if done improperly, hip dysplasia. Swaddled babies may overheat, especially if their heads are partially covered, which can cause hypothermia, even death. There is ongoing debate over whether swaddling prevents infants from waking easily, hinders weight gain, or most troubling, increases the chance of SIDS. There's also a fundamental question of whether the very function of swaddling, keeping the movements of infants restricted in order to soothe, is good for babies, or is it just good for the parents? Quote, to have them pinned down by a tight blanket doesn't make a lot of sense, said Susan Guest, clinical nurse specialist, maternal newborn care, Mount Sinai. You need to know that developmentally, they need to move. They need to be able to put their hand in their mouth.
Right. So we have the obligatory paragraph in the newspaper that basically cites unknown sources of studies to scare the bejesus out of parents and make them think that somehow they're going to harm their baby by putting a blanket around them. The point is that as with anything that we do, you have to look at how long you do it for, it's the dose and duration, right? So are babies swaddled 24 hours a day? No. Are babies swaddled for the first 5 or 6 months of their lives? No. Usually after the first few weeks, they're not swaddled at all. So to say and make claims that somehow you are going to impair the development of a child, of an infant, by swaddling them for a few hours a day, or if you're transporting them and you want them to stay warm, sure, there are different ways to dress a child and keep them warm. They don't have to be swaddled. But to make these claims, and again, all you're reading is so-called expert opinion from people, but really it has no weight behind it. All you're doing is fomenting a sense of increased risk without delineating exactly what that risk is. How many children has this happened to? Where is your evidence for that? You're just speculating on what the potential could be for it, but you're not equating how long you have to do it for in order to see these injuries occur, if they even do occur. So I look at this article and I go, so what? It's not a huge issue. I don't see parents that are swaddling their children all the time.
But you've seen the tired parents, the babies waking up all the time. Da, da, da. There seems to be this claim that if you swaddle the infant, it will sleep longer. From this, I find it fascinating. I know you say what's what, but find it interesting. I don't know what the listeners think. And by the way, every phone line is still available, folks. The rise of the back to sleep campaign in the 1990s advised parents to place babies on their backs when sleeping to prevent SIDS. It set the stage for the increase in swaddling. Many parents found their babies had a difficult time sleeping on their backs, would startle themselves into waking up. They turned to swaddling. In 2002, pediatrician Harvey Karp published the bestseller, The Happiest Baby on the Block, instructed parents, swaddling is the key to reduce crying and helping babies sleep on their backs. I recommend swaddling for all babies, he said in an interview. Even a calm baby will sleep longer and be calmer. Yoni Friedhoff, an Ottawa doctor, quoted in the Globe and Mail article.
Mm-hmm.
Your good friend?
Yes.
He fills in for you on the Wednesday house call.
Yes, he does.
When you're sojourning all over the world.
Right.
Yoni Friedhoff, Ottawa doctor, had, quote, a very long transition to get his firstborn daughter unswaddled.
Right.
I mean, once you swaddle him, you got to unswaddle him.
Mm-hmm.
He and his wife only swaddled their second for about a month, didn't at all with their third, found they had no major sleep issues.
Right.
Quote, the more requirements I think that you give a child in order for them to be able to fall asleep, the more things can go wrong in terms of your child not falling asleep.
Yeah, I agree with him. The point is, and it's essentially backing what I said, there's no evidence one way or the other that it does harm. So for Yoni, he even pointed out, well, they swaddled for a few months and that was it. They didn't do it afterwards. They got more comfortable with taking care of their children. It was the third child. It was like, okay, so what? So the point is that on both sides of this issue, the claims that are being made are not substantiated by any rigorous research. It's all anecdotal reporting. And so until you have something that can, without question, demonstrate that you are either harming or improving a health outcome, then this is really just a moot discussion. There's really nothing to recommend one way or the other. And so, and again, I look at this and I go, this is not really.
You're an anti-swaddler.
I'm not an anti-anything. I'm basically saying show me the evidence of what each of the sides is claiming, and none of them is doing that to any effectiveness. And I have frankly not seen very many children that are harmed one way or the other. And children, each child has a different sleep pattern. So you may have a child that gets swaddled that can't sleep, and you may get one that does sleep. And it's reported anecdotally, hey, I swaddled the child and it slept better. Okay. So it's just one of those stories that it makes a good discussion.
Sure
it
does.
Really doesn't,
I love
but,
it. I think
but,
it's great.
But it really doesn't forward any specific science or recommendation. I think it just illustrates in terms of reporting, it sort of falls into the...
Let's create a controversy.
Let's create a controversy when there
okay.
isn't one.
All right. Peter in Ottawa, you're up first with Dr. Dworkin. Go ahead. Peter?
Yeah. Quick question about... I'm going for knee surgery on Tuesday, and they've given the option of either getting, I guess, general anesthetic or an epidural.
Yeah.
Pros and cons of both, or which way I should go?
I can tell you that what I did is I had the spinal anesthesia or the epidural. I actually watched my surgery because I was interested, but you don't have to watch your surgery. Better recovery time, faster recovery time. General anesthesia usually means that they have to monitor your respiration. Sometimes they'll have to use a machine that helps you breathe because that's what general anesthesia usually does. So it takes a lot longer to come out of general anesthesia. It's just easier on your breathing. You don't have to worry about your having to hyperinflate your lungs again. After general anesthesia, they have to monitor your breathing, make sure you're breathing well on your own. And you get secretions that accumulate. When you have the epidural anesthesia, your everything from the waist up is functioning normally. So there's just a better, safer recovery than compared to general anesthesia. So in terms of risk, the risk is, from my perspective, the risk is much less to you by doing the epidural than it is from the general anesthesia.
That's great.
Okay, Peter, good luck.
Thank you so much.
Yep. You're welcome.
More of your phone calls after the news, folks. Hang on the line. We're going to talk about Melissa's bloated stomach and Dawn's low platelet levels and Susan's allergic reaction, all after the news on CFRA.
My doctor tried to scare me out of smoking my doc. You know, showed me a picture, a smoker's lung. Oh, it was gross and disgusting. Then he showed me a picture of a healthy guy's lung. Oh, it was gross and disgusting. That's why I put him on the inside. You have to look at him all the time, you know? I mean, I thought he'd be in better shape when I quit smoking, but nothing's really changed, you know? Except I can taste my food. That's one thing. All my food now has this incredible taste. Oh, man. Everything I eat, I go, hey, what kind of food is that you're giving me? Oh, there's a zingy, tangy food there, isn't it? What kind of a tangy, zingy kind of a... It's a boiled potato, huh?
Back to the phone calls for Dr. Barry Dworkin. Melissa in Kempville, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. For over a year now, my stomach bloats out where I look like I'm 6 months pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone worse over the summer where it can last up to a week at a time. And I've tried cutting out certain foods to see if it's what I'm eating, and I can't put my finger on what is causing it.
And so when it bloats up very quickly, right?
It does.
Okay. Yes. So we're dealing with something that's obviously reacting within your stomach, because to get bloating that comes and goes, the bloating is essentially increased volume in the stomach or in the intestines. And the only way you get increased volume is with gas collection. And the way you get gas produced is usually with either bacteria that are present that are reacting with something that you're eating to produce it,
okay.
Excess acid being made in your stomach, which the acid with the food that you eat can also produce a gas as part of the chemical reaction that goes on, and also having certain bacteria that shouldn't be there, that sometimes bacteria replace the normal bacteria and cause, as food is digested, usually complex sugars produces a lot of gas. And that can cause a lot of discomfort. I mean, there was a patient of mine who would come in exactly with what you described. He literally could not put his pants on.
No.
His abdomen would just bloat right out almost 1.5 times the size. It was extremely uncomfortable. And as you've done so far, he wrote down everything, and I mean everything that he was eating, and looking to see when he had a reaction. Because if you're having this that goes on for a week, you might be doing something that contributes to this every day without knowing it. And he found, and this is actually quite common, he found that when he ate potatoes, it almost immediately, within a few hours, he would get this kind of bloating. He eliminated that amongst other foods, and he no longer has the bloating.
Okay. See, I've tried cutting, like I've done where I've cut out the breads and all that, and it's still where I've just had chicken and tuna and lots of vegetables and fruit, and it's still happening.
Now, what you have to be is a little bit more, be more of a clinical investigator. So what you have to do is literally make a carry a, like almost like a spreadsheet with you.
Okay.
The time of day down one column.
Okay.
The foods that you're eating in the next column, and in the other column, a check mark where the bloating occurs. And you have to do this for about a week because you want to see where the bloating occurs, where you start to get better, and you're trying to see where that link is between what you're consuming and the bloating that's occurred.
So what do I do when I'm for a full week I'm constantly bloated? Like then how do I figure out?
Well, that's now does this happen all the time?
All the time. It's gone real. It's like constantly. I was fine this morning, and then I had two yogurts, and I'm right back to.
Okay, so now what you if it's the yogurts and it did that, you have to think of lactose intolerance. So there may be so that may be one of the things too. And there's lactose in everything when you think about it.
Okay.
So. Again, so that's an important clue. If all you've had today is the two yogurts and you got bloated, you then have to think about milk products and dairy products. And not all dairy products will do that. A lot of processed products that are, you know, in cakes and things like that may not do that. But yogurt or ice cream or cheeses, that kind of stuff can do it. So I don't want to over-medicalize this and say, okay, go to a gastroenterologist and get the scope done. It's a lot easier at first to do this because it's less invasive and there's certainly no harm in terms of health or harm to your health. This is an uncomfortable situation, but from what you're describing, there really isn't very many other symptoms associated with it other than the bloating. And so what I would say is do this, eliminate the dairy or even take Lactaid, which is the enzyme you can use. There's other products you can use, alpha-galactosidase, which is found in Beano, which is another enzyme that sometimes we need to digest the complex sugars, can also reduce the bloating. But really, it's a lot easier to at least find out what's going on in the environment to do this. You sound like you're quite young, which is another reason why there's unlikely to be any significant damage. And so I would say eliminate the foods, but do the list as best you can and see if you see an improvement. And it can take a little bit of time, but if it still persists after eliminating all the possible foods from the data that you have, that's when you see the gastroenterologist to see if there's something else that's contributing to the problem.
Let's go to Don in Ottawa. Don.
Hi. Thanks, guys, for taking my call. My cardiologist, I had a heart attack 2 years ago, had discovered that my platelets are 50% what they should be.
Mm-hmm.
Three prongs to this question. What causes platelets to be low? What are the consequences? And what can I do to improve the platelet level? He's already got me on folic acid.
Well, first of all, it's important to know what the value was, because to say it was 50% lower doesn't necessarily mean that it's in a bad range. It could be 50% lower of a high value.
He didn't tell me that. He just said, get on folic acid right away.
Okay, so really we don't know. If you're normally platelet counts are around 150,000, that's usually but about 2 or 3% of the population has less than that, and that's still normal. Platelet problems, platelets are responsible for a clotting, for your blood to clot, and you need them to clot, but they have to be extremely low for there to be bleeding problems.
Well, he called me right away, his office called me right away and said, get on the folic acid.
But folic acid really is not going to change much with regards to platelets. It's important to have that number, because usually if it's quite low, you would have been referred to a hematologist in order to evaluate that.
Okay.
I mean, things that can bring down, things that can cause reduced platelet counts include infections. There's also, you can have leukemias. You can have all kinds of things that can do that. And there's essentially a long list. So to list them all out is probably not going to be too helpful. There's medications that'll do this. There's certain foods that can do that, that can cause it. So Usually you do a complete blood count. You see what the platelet level is. You follow it up a month later to see if it really was that low or whether the body has just now made some more.
So what should I do? I mean, I'm left with this. Oh, what are you talking about?
Right.
I'm on the folic acid. What do I do now?
So the next step is when you see your family doctor,
yes,
you get another, it's called a CBC or complete blood count. And it'll check for your platelet count as well.
Okay.
And if it comes out to be the same level as before, it's stable. And it's important to know what the number is. I mean, really, for platelets to cause a low platelet count that will cause bleeding is usually under 20, just to give you an idea where they really start to worry.
Okay.
So even if your platelet count is 80 or 100 or 110, you're not at risk of bleeding. And that then just becomes a matter of trying to figure out, is this something that's just who you are? Or is it from medications that you use? Is it from the heart problems that you had or foods that you're eating? But really, in terms of harm, it's unlikely. Your cardiologist would have, as I mentioned, would have likely sent you to a hematologist if you were in an area where you were at risk of having bleeding.
Okay, so should I just check with my family doctor and continue to take the folic acid?
Yeah, there's no harm in taking the folic acid. And if you've had a heart attack, there's likely medications you're taking to help,
yes,
reduce your chance of bleeding and,
yes,
forming,
well, that's
clots.
That's what I'm confused about,
right,
because I'm taking these medications to thin my blood, and yet they're saying, no, your blood needs to be thickened.
Yeah, it can be confusing, but it's the medications. Sometimes the medications themselves can affect the platelet level. But again, it's very important to have that number, because when we say you've had a 50% drop, you need to know whether that 50% represents a drop into an area that's dangerous or whether it's a drop from an upper level of normal to a lower level of normal.
So bottom line, what is the dangerous level?
Exactly.
What,
so the dangerous level is when you're getting down to around 20,
okay,
that's pretty dangerous. There are people that have 40, 50. But again, if you're down in that range of 20 to 50, you're going to be seeing a hematologist to find out what's going on.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Good luck, Don. Let's go to Susan on line four. Susan.
Hello.
Hi, what? Susan. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Dorfman.
All right.
I got stung yesterday by, I think, what they call a yellow jacket or a wasp,
mm-hmm,
on the arm about 3 inches above the wrist.
Right.
I have had reactions to bites by wasps before.
Mm-hmm.
I came home, took some Benadryl, and it seemed to help. Got up this morning, and I was swollen from my wrist to my elbow,
right,
red,
mm-hmm,
swollen, and it's hot. My question, and so now I'm doing the Benadryl, but my question is, how much can I actually take? Because the box says I can only take one. Should I, and how long should I wait before I go to the doctor?
Well, Benadryl is usually 25 to 50 milligrams.
I can go as high as 50, okay.
Right. The issue with regards to bites and when an arm gets red, if it got red that quickly all the way from your wrist to your elbow, that is unlikely to be an infection, because you don't see skin infections travel that fast in 24 hours, especially if the entire arm is like that. It still has to be looked at. Ideally, what you would want to do is even take a small marker and mark the outline of how high up it goes on the arm to,
okay,
see if it passes that line over the next day. Usually, bites will tend to resolve over 24 to 48 hours, especially if it's an allergic response. And if you have a known allergy to it, it's not surprising that the arm flared up that way. There are other antihistamines that you can use as well that aren't sedating. That this won't make you tired.
Okay.
And you can buy those over the counter. There's all the ones that they advertise for allergies, the 24-hour ones that don't cause sedation.
Okay.
Any of them will work. So I don't want to name any particular brand.
I understand.
And but I would say that if the arm is, if you develop a fever, if the arm continues, the red area continues to spread, then I would see your doctor. And I would only wait another day or so before doing that.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thanks very much.
You're very welcome, Susan.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's it. All over. Marilyn and Rob, sorry we didn't get a chance to get,
yes,
to your phone calls.
Good questions
but,
today.
But you'll be back on Sunday.
I'll be back on
with
Sunday.
With the Sunday house call, so another opportunity, mm-hmm, for the listeners to ask some health-related questions. And good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Don't forget, Health Headlines with Dr. Dworkin every morning during Madeley in the morning at about 10 to 7.